Hello and welcome to PI Chats, an informal discussion with Perimeter Institute researchers on a very exciting and timely topic, faster-than-light neutrinos. Both the physics community and the general public are abuzz with news from CERN that neutrinos have been detected traveling faster than the speed of light. This raises interesting questions both on the experimental and theoretical fronts. My name is Richard Epp. I'm part of the outreach team here at Perimeter Institute, and I will be your host. Thank you for joining us on this webinar. I'm delighted to introduce our panel of researchers. On my immediate left is Natalia Toro, specializing in particle physics. And to her left is Laurent Fradel, specializing in quantum gravity. Both are faculty members at Perimeter Institute. I'll start by asking our researchers to introduce the experiment that caused such a stir and what some next steps might be on the experimental and theoretical fronts. For those of you tuning in, on this webinar, I encourage you to type in your questions for our panelists. We will try to get to as many questions as are possible within our time limits. So, Natalia, I wonder if you could start us off by describing in basic terms what the experiment was about. And I have a diagram here to help.
Sure. So the experiment that everybody's talking about is OPERA, the Oscillation Project with Emulsion Tracking Apparatus. And this is an experiment that uses neutrinos produced at CERN and then follows those neutrinos all the way over to Gran Sasso underneath the Alps in Italy. So what you see on the screen now is a little cartoon of the neutrinos traveling through the Earth from CERN to Gran Sasso, 700 kilometers. And if you go to the picture you had earlier, you can see both the tunnel of the superproton synchrotron on the left, which is the accelerator at CERN that produces the neutrinos, and the detector at Gran Sasso on the right. The detector is actually built of 150,000 bricks of photographic film. And these bricks, the photographic film on these bricks detects the arrival of the neutrinos. So what the recent result does is essentially just measure the speed of these neutrinos. Now, speed, as you know, is in principle a very simple measurement, just the distance traveled by the neutrinos divided by the time it takes them to get there. So the real crux of this issue is understanding how well they can measure that distance and how well they can measure that time, and then comparing the result to the speed of light, which certainly all evidence to date indicates is the absolute speed limit, the fastest speed that anything can travel.
Okay. Thank you, Natalia. So we're talking about neutrinos here. So Laurent, I wonder if you might help us to understand, what is a neutrino?
Well, a neutrino is a particle of the standard model that is doesn't have any charge and is interacting via the weak interactions. And it's produced in radioactive decays or nuclear reactions, for instance, produced copiously, in the fusion process into the sun, and we're bombarded by neutrino all the time. Because they are so weakly interacting, they are very difficult to catch, and they travel a long way, in the universe.
And so that's what allows them to travel through the rock from Geneva to San Grasso.
Exactly. That's why, the only particles they get in San Grasso are coming from CERN are the neutrinos and not the other particles which are produced there.
Okay. So back to Natalia. So what is the purpose of the OPERA experiment? What are they trying to do?
So the purpose of OPERA really goes back to another phenomenon discovered back in robustly discovered in 1998 called neutrino oscillations. This is where neutrinos actually have, because of the detailed properties of their masses, they actually change from, say, an electron neutrino, the type of neutrino that interacts with electrons, into a muon neutrino as they travel. Or, in the case of interest to OPERA, from muon neutrinos to tau neutrinos. Now, we're pretty sure from indirect observations that this transition from muon to tau is what's going on. These neutrino oscillations, but OPERA was really designed primarily to test that directly. So they produce a beam of muon neutrinos at CERN, These are the neutrinos that interact with muons, and try to detect the rate at which they turn into tau neutrinos that would interact, tau neutrinos. So they're looking for tau neutrinos at Gran Sasso, even though what they produced was muon neutrinos. Of course, to date, they saw their first tau neutrino in May 2010. And I'm actually not sure if they've seen others since then. They certainly haven't seen enough to make a detailed oscillation measurement yet. But they have measured a lot of muon neutrinos.
Okay. So now to the heart of the matter. So in the course of conducting these experiments, they happened upon a quite unexpected and puzzling result. So I'm going to put up the experimental result here in the form of a number here. And I would like you, our researcher panel, discuss what this means. Okay, so there's a time delta t of about 60 nanoseconds. And there's a ratio of difference in velocity to speed of light, comparing a velocity to speed of light of 25 parts per million. And there's a 6 sigma. What do these numbers mean, starting with the delta t? Natalia, do you want to jump in?
So this delta t is how much, and again, this comes down to measuring the, this is the difference between the time the neutrinos arrived and the time they think the neutrinos would have arrived if they traveled at the speed of light. So that's 60.7 nanoseconds, 60.7 billionths of a second early. And there are two pieces of uncertainty there, statistical and systematic. The statistical error is basically that they can't measure the travel time that precisely because they only have 16,000 neutrinos. They can't identify, that sounds like a lot, but they can't identify which proton each neutrino came from. So they have to do a statistical analysis to get this travel time. And that fit doesn't give them infinite precision on the delay. It gives them an uncertainty of about 7 nanoseconds, so 1/10 of the delta t. Now the second number there, plus or minus 7.4 nanoseconds, that's what's called a systematic error. What that refers to is really uncertainties in whether the time that they are measuring, the way they're interpreting the measurement is correct. So for example, if you look at the, let me show you, flash a picture from the paper here. This is a picture of all the circuit diagram, and I'm actually don't even know what all of the little boxes on there mean, but you'll see lots of numbers next to the arrows on the picture. And these correspond to different time delays in the instrument that they need to correct for. They don't know all of these time delays precisely. Some of them they know to within a precision of 1 nanosecond, half a nanosecond, and there are delays both on the CERN side and on the Gran Sasso side. So any uncertainty they have in exactly what those delays are translates into a problem of interpreting their statistical measurement. They don't know exactly how to interpret it, and so and their estimate of how far off their interpretation is the 7.4 nanoseconds on the previous page.
Maybe another example of you know how precise this measurement is that, for instance, you have to measure a distance, which is of 730 kilometers. And in order to get this level of precision, they have to be sure that they measure this distance up to a precision which is of the order of 20 centimeters. So they have to first measure the distance at this level of precision. Then they have to use, because they also measure time, so they have to be able to synchronize the clock, and they use a high-precision GPS system to be able to go down to this level of precision. And then, as Natalia said, well, you have to take also into account the time it takes from, you know, receiving the signal somewhere and then, you know, analyzing it in you know, some other place on your computer. And, you know, you have to be able to know exactly what time it takes there to some level of precision. So the job they are trying to do to get to that level of precision, you have to do a tremendous job of high precision measurements at all level. And then there's the last part is that, as Natalia says, it's not like you send one, you know, you don't send one particle at some place in CERN that you know where the, you don't know exactly where the neutrino was produced. So it's not like you're tracking one neutrino, you know, in CERN, and then you're sure that it's one particle you receive. What you're tracking is you're sending a pulse of proton, you know, that's going to decay and produce a neutrino, and then get at San Grasso statistics of neutrino arriving, and then you have to reconstruct the time of arrival. So there's extra hours there.
Okay.
But yeah.
So then that time, that early time of arrival, that delta t of about 60 nanoseconds, corresponds to moving faster than the speed of light by about 25 parts per million. So it's a small amount, but it's a significant amount. So that six sigma, what does that six sigma mean?
Right. Well, actually, if I can just step back briefly to the 25 parts per million, I mean, that feels like a very small number. But a big part of the reason that you've heard a lot of physicists, and certainly I'd count myself, expressing skepticism about this experiment is that also at the same time, 25 parts per million is actually a huge number compared to the effects that have been excluded in other types of particles and lower energy neutrinos. So we'll get to that later, but I just did want to throw out 25 parts per million in this business of Lorentz violation is actually a really large effect. So that's pretty surprising. It's one reason to think very carefully about this experiment. But now let me get to the six sigma. So if you add these statistical errors and systematic errors in quadrature, that means take the statistical error, square it, square the systematic error, add those numbers and take the square root. You'll get a total that's about 10 nanoseconds. That's an estimate of the total uncertainty, including all the effects, how well they can measure the neutrinos, and how well they've calibrated everything. The uncertainty in that number, delta t. So they're saying that this is six times the expected uncertainty. So their measurement, that's a measurement of how confident they are in the result. Usually, 5 sigma is a sort of common standard in the field for a discovery. So this is bigger than that. We should all be jumping up and believing it. But there's other things to look at. One is, how well does one really understand the systematic errors? As Laurent was stressing, there's a lot of numbers that you add and subtract to get the distance, to get the time. And if one number was left off, or if a few of the numbers were just mismeasured by a little bit more than they think, that 7.4 nanoseconds could grow into 20 nanoseconds. So that's one reason the six sigma is not quite everything that we expect. But if it were just statistics, six sigma would be a very interesting number.
Okay.
Maybe a word on statistics and systematics for people. I mean, a simple way to trace the difference is that statistical error is something that, you know, you can improve with time by getting more events. So, you know, by waiting 1 year or 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, you know, you're reducing your statistical error.
And systematic, up to 16,000.
Yeah, and they have waited for 3 years, you know, so they have accumulated enough statistical error to go down to this level. Now, systematic is something that doesn't change with time. It's something that is part of your, I don't know, uncertainty of the measurement apparatus. So just, you know, just to precise. So most of the questions about the experiment are on the systematics.
Okay. So if I'm a high school student and I'm in a physics class, I learn that if I have an interesting result and it's within the error bars, then that interesting result is confirmed. But now we see an interesting result which is within the error bars, but we still question it. And so that, what my sense is, that's where the systematic error is being questioned. Is there some unforeseen or overlooked systematic error? Is that fair to say that?
Yeah, and I guess in the statement of the experiment, the person is, you know, maybe you wanted to read that statement.
Yeah, so there's an interesting quote here from Professor Antonio Eredatio of CERN, who was involved with the OPERA project, and he says, "My dream would be that another independent experiment finds the same thing, then I would be relieved. But for now, we are not claiming things. We want just to be helped by the community in understanding our crazy result, because it is crazy." So Laurent, could you talk a little bit about the process of science involved here, please?
Right. So I think what's happening here with Opera is a beautiful way, it's a beautiful demonstration of how science works. The people in Opera Experiment have done is they have done a really thorough job. And they have been sitting on this, they've worked for 3 years, they've been sitting on this, very extremely surprising result for 6 months, trying to check their systematics. Now they come out and say, well, you know, this is what we believe we have measured. It's not what we expect. It's not what we want to happen. We cannot, given all the data we have analyzed, this is the result we really, this is what we have found. It's important to notice that there's something they have done in the experiment which is called blind analysis. That is, they first gather the data, and then they have to independently evaluate what is the systematic error in their apparatus. But they do that before, in fact, knowing exactly what is the data, mm-hmm. right? And another type of experiment which would be unblind, but would be that you give your systematics after knowing the data. And right. Now people don't do that anymore. So, they have done this thorough job of carrying the systematics, and they claim this anomalous result. So they present their work. It has been, it's now under scrutiny. They're asking other people to ask that. But this is really how science works. Somebody comes in, finds something which is not exactly what he wants, question it up to the point where he cannot go forward, put it out, and then it's questioned by other people, and it's either confirmed, by other experiments, or other experiment disagrees with them, or somebody else which analyzed their data will find some maybe possible other source of systematics, as Natalia right. was explaining. Yep. But it's an open debate, and everybody there is ready to. Most people will expect that the result will not stand, but if it does stand, then people are ready to move on with that result. So there's an interesting moment, and it really shows how science works in some right. sense. That it's crazy, but it's still a scientific procedure which we're undergoing,
yes.
right? Because the way they present the result and the way it's analyzed,
Yeah, and
it's very exciting. I mean, it's a huge deal. If it turns out to be true, I mean, this would be perhaps one of the most profound experiments in 100 years. This is one of those once in a century kind of experimental results.
Yeah, at the same time, I want to underscore that, as Laurent said, this is really the beginning of a global effort to understand whether there's any explanation that makes sense and to test this in similar experiments, in different experiments, in every possible way. For people in the science world, we get experiments that get refuted with exciting results that get refuted all the time. A lot of them don't make it out into the world, but this is really a slow continuing process. So in the last year or two, I think there have been two or three collider results that have sort of gone away. There have been dark matter results in the last few years that go away. The phenomenon of neutrino oscillations that I mentioned earlier mm-hmm. did stay, but it was a decades-long process from Ryerson Cohen's first evidence for it to Super Kamiokande in 1998 really clinching the deal. So this is the beginning, and it may be a long saga or a short one. We don't know.
Okay. So I think we're going to move to questions fairly soon. I just wanted to talk about there have been other experiments that have measured speed of travel of neutrinos, offering some hints that there may be faster than light neutrinos. I wonder if either of you could talk a little bit about that, some of the other experiments, like NINOS and supernovas.
Well, there's been two type of, the two type of experiments concerning neutrinos. So the first one are really, which nail down the speed of neutrino in a very sharp manner was experiments coming from a supernova event in 1987. So supernova is some kind of dramatic explosion of a neutron star, and then it expels the shell out. So it delivers a humongous amount of energy in a very short amount of time. And this explosion was witnessed by several detectors, neutrino detectors, at about the same times. Unfortunately, these detectors were not really synchronized together at that time. But this neutrino traveled for a distance of about 200,000 light years. So they traveled for a very, very, very long time. And they had energy around 10 MeV. And these neutrinos were really proven to travel at the speed of light. At a level of precision, this is what Natalia was saying earlier, that when we were saying, 25 part in a million, these neutrinos were proven to travel at the speed of light, to a level of precision which was around, a part in a billion. So 10,000 times more precise, right? So in that respect, there's first the huge conflict between the OPERA experiment and the supernova experiments. So now these two experiments are happening at different energies. So there are other types of experiments which have been been done at OPERA level of energies, which also seemed to indicate some kind of anomalous propagation of neutrino, but the uncertainty on this experiment was, very, very high. Maybe Natalia can comment more on that. There was two, Minos, and then another earlier experiment, Fermilab in 79.
Yeah, we have a graph here that we might want to show. Let me just make a comment on that supernova result. So the fact is that the neutrinos, the antineutrinos from that supernova, arrived here before the light by a matter of a few hours. But that's nothing to be, but that didn't cause any concern or alarm, because there's a simple explanation. One could imagine that as the supernova explodes, it's an optically dense medium, and the particles of light, the photons, have a bit of trouble getting out, but the neutrinos come straight out. So having arrived a couple of hours early is not a big deal. However, if you were to take this, this OPERA data, the fact that it's 25 parts per million faster than the speed of light, and translated over that distance, it would suggest that the antineutrinos from that supernova would have to arrive here not a few hours in advance, but a few years in advance. So that's just further to your point, that there's a huge difference, a huge discrepancy here that needs to be discussed.
Yeah, I agree. Do you want to say more on this?
Not much. I mean, the Minos experiment has said that they can probably do a more precise test in the next year or two. So I think in the next year. So already we're looking towards independent studies soon with the same level of precision as the OPERA result. Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can show the graph of the different
sure.
experiment, the Giudice graph.
So I see we have a bunch of questions coming in here. So why don't we show the graph quickly? And then we'll jump to our questions.
This is this one.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is the top graph there. That we want to be looking at. And it's a comparison of neutrino energies on the x-axis for different experiments and how large of a deviation from the speed of light they're consistent with. So the supernova results are very tightly constrained to be less than a part in a trillion deviations from the speed of light. The OPERA results you can see up at much higher energies, 1,000 times higher energies, are the only ones that are completely inconsistent with light speed for the neutrinos. If you look at all the other bars, even though the dots are high, the fact that the bars go all the way down to the bottom of the graph is telling us that actually those experiments are reasonably consistent with neutrinos not traveling faster than light, traveling at the speeds we'd expect. So it's these two OPERA results that are, that these are just two different energy values they're studying. They give the, that are causing this stir. Minos is the one I was saying will have a better result within a year, is the one sort of in the middle of the graph.
Okay. And so moving forward, we would see probably more of such experiments. So if so, I have a question here from our viewers. So if this experiment is confirmed, and we do have faster than light neutrinos, does this mean that time travel is possible?
Okay, so that's what this question. In fact, to answer this question, it depends on what type of. So let's say first. So you're saying, let's suppose that you know OPERA is confirmed, and there are other measurements, right, and they confirm this possibility. Now, what does it mean from the theory point of view? What does it mean from the theory point of view depends on the model you're going to use for its explanation. So the short answer to your question is no, in the sense that what your question implies is that, let's say, if you have a part, if special relativity is true, that is, if it's possible to have physics invariant for any type of observer boosted with respect to one another, and at the same time you have a particle moving, you witness a particle moving faster than the speed of light, then this particle will be what's called a tachyon. And then what happens is that if you have a tachyon, it's possible by changing an observer to violate causality. Right. Okay. So if you have special relativity, which is still valid and witness a particle, exactly valid and witness a particle going faster than the speed of light, then you have a problem with causality. And this is something that you don't want to envision. So now there are other possibilities.
So by causality, you mean?
By causality, I mean that, yeah, that you will be able to go backward in time.
Okay.
Right. So this is under the, so that's why, having such a result, will force you to question some things about the principle of relativity. On the other hand, there are models like extra dimension models, which assumes that there are more than four dimensions, and then you can cook up possibilities like that by warping this extra dimension. So there's and there you don't have to violate naively the principle of relativity, but it's really model dependent. Right? Another possibility would be, having a frame dependent. So special relativity is not true, and then maybe there's a preferred frame, but there are extremely high constraints on that for the other particles, the leptons or the photon. And then you'll have to explain why it does affect only the neutrino and not the other particles. So there, it really depends on the model you're using.
Okay, good.
You want to?
Yeah, I mean, maybe just in discussing these models, we should mention that these aren't models sitting on the table that we can say this is my good model to explain this data. Laurent has his, and we've got 30 models flying around that we just need to test. There's ideas for models that would certainly not allow you to travel backwards in time, and that also, but nobody has found a good way to reconcile all the data.
Yeah,
it's a model that we'd have faith in.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
I think the point you were making is one I'd agree with, just that the logically, neutrinos traveling faster than light plus special relativity would allow at least neutrinos to go backwards in time. But most of us would, if this result were confirmed, would probably bet on a modification to special relativity rather than on the neutrinos, or at least equally to the neutrinos traveling backwards in time, maybe more.
Yeah, and you're right to say that it's a very early stage, and if this result was confirmed, it would be extremely surprising because there's no theoretical framework that allow us to really deal with that type of result fully consistently, and you know, and reconcile, you know, all the other data we have with that result.
Thank you. So here's a second question from Dennis Mercier's class. Sahil and Vinay ask, since neutrinos are so rare, what impact does this result have on real life, our lives?
Well, I think it's far too early to say, is the answer.
First of all, are they rare? Are neutrinos
They're
rare?
Actually extremely common. Mm-hmm. So there are neutrinos produced copiously in the sun, copiously in the atmosphere. There are neutrinos passing through your hands right now. What they are is rarely interacting.
Okay. So if I remember correctly, from the sun, if I were to hold my thumb up like this, there are so many neutrinos coming from the fusion reactions at the center of the sun, that if I hold my thumb up like this, then in 1 second's time, there's something like 65 billion neutrinos just passed through my thumb. So they are copious.
Yeah.
Copious quantities around us.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if they can travel through 730 kilometers of Earth without really noticing the Earth there, they can travel through your thumb without them noticing your thumb or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, big discoveries in physics have traditionally started in very obscure places and led to significant changes to our lives. You know, special relativity led to GPS. And quantum mechanics led to solid-state physics, to the semiconductors in your phone and computer, right? So if this were to hold up, would it lead to an understanding that had an impact on our lives? Probably. But the neutrinos themselves are probably not the most interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that.
The real life.
The question is more general than that. That is, you know, if you ask the question, let's say 100 years ago, when special relativity was discovered, a priori, you know, the fact that time doesn't flow at same speed for everybody, you know, is true only for very fast particles. So it would be irrelevant. Or quantum mechanics looks like. But all this discovery, each time you have a profound change in theoretical physics or a profound understanding of a new phenomena, it trickles down to consequences that down the line 100 years ago are impossible to predict. Right. Most of the technology we use today or we communicate with are due to quantum mechanics and to some extent also special relativity. So,
So these seemingly esoteric discoveries can have an impact on our life.
Yeah, any big discovery in theoretical physics have humongous impact. Okay. What kind of impact is impossible to predict?
Right. Okay, thank you. So here's another question. Would you comment on what the implications are to E equals mc squared if faster than light velocity proves to be true?
The short answer is we don't know. It's really model dependent. Some models, are proposing. So in some very vague model, people are playing with the idea that maybe you have to modify E equal mc squared relation, and then. But then you have to work out all the possible consequences of that type of modification. Okay. And whether it's even that type of modification is consistent with the data.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about what a model is? So we're throwing that term around a lot, models in science. Could you talk about what are models? What does that mean? You have to have a model in science.
Yeah, that's a maybe different level of models and consistency and let's say difference between models and then theory. Or,
right.
You know, so first, let's say if you have a bunch of experiments, you might want to have something we used to call phenomenological models, some kind of formula that accounts for what you see and at the same time maybe make some prediction, you know, some type of prediction.
Right.
And then there's maybe a higher level of requirement that you want to have is some kind of full level of consistency, which can lead to a new theory, where not only you have just a model that explains, let's say, this type of phenomena, for neutrino, but includes all the rest of the particles and includes all the forces and it fits very well and harmoniously also with the previous history of physics.
So we have another question here. It's a long question. the most questionable part of the archive preprint is the analysis of the systematic errors, particularly the delays at the source. It seems that the delays are estimated as differences between 2006 and later setups. Such estimates are, first of all, indirect, and secondly, miss some important unknown parts. The accuracies of these delays seem seriously underestimated. Could you give a more detailed comment on how the team came up with a systematic error estimate as few as a few nanoseconds? As small as a few nanoseconds. Do you want to put up a graph here?
First of all, that's a really good question. It's something that I wouldn't be too glib about dismissing their work. They did try to do an extremely careful job measuring the delays in every component of their system. But there is absolutely the possibility that they missed something. For example, all of these different pieces, maybe if you zoom in, one can see a lot of them have a 1 nanosecond uncertainty. What that 1 nanosecond is coming from in each individual component is that they had a pulser that produces a pulse every second that they could use to calibrate them. Every nanosecond. Now, a nanosecond is a very short amount of time to us. It's a very long amount of time to an atomic clock. So I think it's not crazy. Atomic clocks, I think, have a 10 to the minus 16 second precision. They might be even better than that. So that's the nanosecond is 10 million times longer than their than the base precision of an atomic clock, if I remember correctly. So the nanosecond numbers aren't crazy, but there's absolutely the possibility that something nobody's come up with yet could have affected this.
Maybe here there's another curve that shows maybe a bit more precise. This is supposed to represent, as we say, there's a pulse which is sent through, and this is supposed to represent the beginning and the end of the pulse. So when is the beginning of this pulse arriving at the detector, and when is it ending? And then you get this, and it's focusing just on this part and the neutrino event you see there. And then the way you calibrate the time is by fitting a curve. The shape of the pulse, and it's supposed to be this red curve, and then you have to pass it through so that it fits the data. And this is also where. And clearly, when you look at the details, the fit looks pretty good, but you see, for some curve it looks pretty good, for some other it doesn't look that good. So people are going to look more into details, into the analysis of these fits and how it went. But at this stage, the team did a very thorough job, so it's not going to be an obvious thing that they missed. It would take maybe a while. They sit on this result for 6 months, as they said, and they hoped it would go away. Right. But there is lots of possibility of higher systematics in the measurements.
Good, thank you. So here's another question. So I have read that if true, the result would have to violate Lorentz invariance, which is what much of physics is built upon. Would a positive result therefore invalidate all of this physics? Would a faster than light neutrinos invalidate all the results, this physics?
I'm going to take issue with this word invalidate, because you could apply the same result to Newton's laws, and they would work extremely well to predict what happens if I throw this glass off the table, for example. In fact, they work extremely well to predict how spacecraft travel. But there's small corrections to within the regime of classical physics, where we expect it to apply. The changes to Newton's laws, for from quantum mechanics or from special relativity are small things. And a change, if there is a consistent framework that describes these neutrino results and other physics, a new theory, it will be an extension or a modification of the existing laws. We've already tested special relativity extremely well in many different areas. So it's not going to be completely thrown out. At most, it will be modified a little bit.
So that brings a question I had in my mind. So has Einstein's special relativity been challenged before, and has it been, have modifications been suggested before?
Yes, in the theory side, people have speculated, you know, the speculations around about possibility that, you know, as Natalia say, modifications of special relativity, tiny modifications should be envisioned. For instance, one line of speculation comes from thinking about quantum gravity, the fact that at some level, the notion of space-time is going to, you know, dissolve or be replaced by some other concept, and the notion of locality too. And in that context, people have tried to propose effective models of how the deviation would show up. So people have thought about that. The problem is that the scale of quantum gravity, you know, is way. I mean, if you think in terms of quantum gravity, you're going to predict that maybe you're going to see something surprising. But at an energy scale, and you're going to see some modification of the laws of relativity or some extension. But the extension is going to be way, 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 way smaller. What would you naively expect should be way, 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 way smaller than what Opera is claiming. So what's surprising about Opera, from a theoretical point of view, it's the scale that they claim they have witnessed. Right? If they were, you know, seeing the same effect, but it was a delta V over C of 10 to the minus 19, then, you know, people would be. So the scale at which these things happen is extremely surprising and not really. I don't think there's models before that accounted for that large. It's a small deviation, as Natalia said, compared to special relativity. You really, to get to that level of deviation, you really have to go and have clocks that measure things at nanoseconds. You have to be able to measure, you know, thousands of kilometers at the centimeter level. I mean, you see, you have to do all these things. So it's not a big deviation in that sense.
Right.
But compared to the scale of quantum gravity, where we expect that clearly something will happen, it's a huge deviation.
Surprising.
Yeah, and also, so compared to the scales where one might expect effects from quantum gravity, and compared to the scales where the same effect has been measured in other particles, say in electrons and light, there's all kinds of analogous parameters of how much, you know, how much could electrons travel faster than light, or could photons, could light actually not always travel at the same speed depending on its energy. These numbers have been measured not to one part in 10 to the 5, 10, 20 parts in a billion, but to parts in 10 to the 15 for electrons, 10 to the 17, I think, for photons, but even higher on some particular parameters. So there are a lot of constraints, and these are things that you'd really expect in most theories to feed into each other. So it would be sort of a strange situation. Not only is the effect much larger than you'd expect theoretically, it's much larger than any other effect you'd see in the world. Why are neutrinos so special? Maybe they're just special because they're so hard to measure that we measure them wrong despite very careful efforts. But
that's really exciting. So I'm just looking at the clock here, and I think we're running short on time. So what I'd like to do is move to just a couple of summary questions addressed to both of you. So if this experimental result is overturned and it is found that neutrinos in fact do not move faster than the speed of light, how might this exercise still have been useful for science?
I think it would have been useful. You know, I think it's interesting in the sense that it would trigger more experiment. It will trigger presumably a deeper understanding of neutrino. And it will maybe refine the technology we use to measure distance and clock. And you know, on the theory level, it forces us to shake a bit our understanding and put together the data. So you know, even if it comes with a negative result, I think it will be, you know, it will be, we'll have gained a deeper understanding of this question, maybe ruled out completely the possibility of such effects. So it would be very beneficial to the community.
Yeah, I mean, these are all, so I agree on the practical side of everything Laurent said. This basic, you know, the surprise of this result is based on things that were proposed in 1905 by Einstein, that for a hundred years, they've been, almost 100, they've been accepted truths, right? Certainly, all of us doing physics today grew up with special relativity as one of the things that we were taught was true about nature, right? So it's always useful, as long as one thinks constructively and self-consistently, I think it is always useful to be reminded that, hey, we should really explore what it would mean and what consequences could be of modifying these frameworks.
Okay. So on the flip side, if the experimental result is confirmed, then my guess is that experimentalists and theorists are going to be pretty busy. In how so?
Is it too early to say at this point?
I think it's too early to say if it's confirmed. Yeah. I think it's too early.
It's not easy to measure. It's not easy to make up a theory that'll work to explain it. So, you know. Mm-hmm.
But it would certainly be interesting and exciting, whatever it turns out.
It would be.
Okay. So I think we need to close here. So I'd like to thank our researchers, Laurent and Natalia, for volunteering their time and their expertise to come here and talk about this exciting topic and answer some of our questions. And I'd like to thank our online viewers for tuning in to PI Chats. Good day.